Good evening, everyone. Nice to see you. Nice to be here. So what to say tonight? I was having a conversation with someone, maybe last night it was, I think, or no. Yeah, maybe it was yesterday. And it was the question of what we call greed, anger, and ignorance, what we call the three poisons. She was saying that she didn't really feel that she had a problem with the first one, with greed, that she felt generous and didn't really see how that could limit her. And I said to her, as Bernie Glassman used to say to people, look closer. I think it's fair to say that we all have issues with these three poisons. It's human. We didn't go into, when I said look closer, we didn't go into, so what else could she look at? But it reminded me of how we have limited views even of these poisons, as we say, that limit us. We can see greed as attachment, right? So it can be attachment to money, can be attachment to an identity, can be attachment to objects. It can be attachment to that box of things you have in your attic that you never look at, but you can't part with. It can be, an attachment to the cookbooks that you never open and probably never will open, but that you can't, that you keep there anyway. Can be an attachment to an identity, so who we think we are, in relation to other people. It can be, oh, I'm a professional. Oh, I'm a certain nationality. I'm an artist. I'm someone who's angry a lot. I'm someone who's not angry a lot. I'm friendly. I'm not friendly. I'm shy. I'm not shy. All these things we can identify with and hang on to then. It can be even an attachment to our explanation of how things are. This is how I'm explaining this situation, and that's how it is. It can be an attachment to a belief. An attachment to how things should be, how we think they should be. Or shouldn't be. And so there's a lot of things we can look at with hanging on to and clinging with this attachment, this greed. And I read somewhere recently that something about how Zen practice was basically about renunciation. And how ultimately renunciation is choosing to be free. We think of renunciation as being limiting us, giving up things that will reduce us, close us off. But in fact, if we look at it completely differently, we can see it as it's a choice to be free. a free from identities, objects, explanations for how things are, belief systems. It's not necessarily that we are renouncing our favorite cup or something. It's we are renouncing our attachment to it, which makes us free to then drink out of any cup. We don't have to have that cup. I'm sure everybody has. I have my favorite cups, you know. Tonight I'm drinking out of my third favorite cup. I have a favorite cup. Then I have a second favorite cup. And now I have the third one because the other two are dirty and I haven't put the dishwasher on. So I have the third favorite cup. And I'm very aware of this. And sometimes I just intentionally take a different cup, not one of those cups. Then, of course, I have them ordered. Then there's a fourth cup and a fifth cup, and there's kind of an order to them. But then there's some that I never take. So sometimes I think, well, maybe I should just take that cup and see. Am I free to do that? You know, and can I choose to be free to do that, take that different cup? This I can say this from years and years and years of training, of practicing this. And yet every time we sit down on our cushion, that's what we're doing. We're renouncing everything else we could be doing at that moment. We're renouncing all the activity that, because we're just sitting still in one place. So we're renouncing all those other places we could be. Those other chairs we could be sitting on, the other rooms we could be in, the other activities we could be, you know, watching a series on TV or having a beer with a friend at the cafe, taking a bath, you know, we could be doing so many other things, but we've renounced it all to just sit here. And just sitting there, we're renouncing so many other things too. We're renouncing our intention to renounce clinging to our thoughts, clinging to these objects that our mind creates that we believe will make us happy. These, whether it's a thought, an idea, a scenario, you know, of how we'll do something tomorrow or the meal we will eat or something. And so we choose to renounce that for this half an hour while we sit. That's an incredibly radical thing to do. That's why I always say this practice is so radical. It goes not only against the general tendency of society as we know it today, but also just the basic functioning, ignorant functioning of humans forever, of, you know, generating these desirable things in our mind that we believe they promise real happiness and contentment. And yet, none of it will cause fundamentally happiness. None of it will ease this basic hunger that we have. Because in order to ease that basic hunger, we have to renounce so that we can see things as they are, so we can see ourselves as we are, right? So like with the cups, I sometimes give my own example of when I was living single mother with my small child. I left my life in Paris in the Marais, which at the time was not the kind of Disneyland Marais that it is today, but it was a really nice neighborhood. And I lived in a beautiful apartment in an 18th century building with wooden floor, with oak floors and high ceilings, and, you know, made great money and great life. And I left that all to go live in a Zen center in Montreuil. As I've often said, you know, that was the other side of the periphérique, which for me at the time was like the absolute desert. Living on the other side of the periphérique, which is the road that goes around Paris, was just unthinkable. But I did it and lived in this center and, you know, lived in the house next door to where I live now. And my husband and I soon had another baby, and my daughter had the room next door, and the rest of us lived in one room, and that was our bedroom and our office and the baby's room and everything in that room. And then when there was sitting, that was where the Dyson line was in my room on the floor next to my bed. And I gave up, you know, everything. And in the first few months, it wasn't, I loved being where I was, but I hated letting go of where I had been. And so it was really painful for me to even think about where I had been living and the life I had before. I was so identified with it. So I couldn't go to that neighborhood even. I couldn't even set foot in the neighborhood because it was too painful. Until, and I've told this story before, until one day I had to go through it because there was a huge metro strike for weeks on end. And we had to drive everywhere. And we were in a massive traffic jam. And we had to go down this street that went through my neighborhood. And we actually went past the Place des Vosges, which was my child's playground when I was living in Paris. That's where she went after school to play, on the Place des Vosges, which is just this beautiful, it's the oldest square in Paris, beautiful thing. So we had to drive by it. And I was really worried about it. But as we drove by, I was really happy to drive by it and see it and appreciate it. And then we drove on and there was another neighborhood. And I was really happy to see that neighborhood too. And then another neighborhood. And I was really happy to see that neighborhood too. And it was as if I could enjoy all of it, appreciate all of it, because I had let go, I had renounced the one. I could then appreciate the many because I had let go of this one neighborhood and this one identity. And I had this feeling like, well, everywhere was my home. It wasn't just that neighborhood. Living on the other side of the periphérique was different, but it was my home as well. I could be home everywhere. Because I had renounced that one place being my home. So it's like, you know, I renounced my favorite cups so I can like enjoy this cup. It doesn't really matter which cup it is, you know. It's completely irrational why I like one cup other than another. I mean, there's no real explanation for it because they're basically all the same, you know. But that's how things work, right? We have these attachments to things. And we can have a long story about it. I can say, oh, you know, I have sentimental attachment to one cup more than another, or I don't like the color green, or whatever, you know. But that's just mind creating this stuff. And then I believe it, and I become attached to it. So that's the attachment and the greed aspect of the poisons. If we look at the anger or aversion aspect, because we call it anger, because when we have an aversion to something and it's not going like we want it to go, we become angry usually. I have no problem with with my telephone until it doesn't work and then I become angry. Or you know, the cats, I'm perfectly happy with the cats until one does something that I don't want her to do, and then I'm angry. And this is aversion, okay? It's like the flip side of attachment. It's the other side of the coin of attachment. So it's and we're pushing away of what we don't want because we're trying to hold on to what we do want, and it's not working. And so then we're pushing away what we don't want. And we push, we resist when what we want is not staying. So we have an aversion to that, to the impermanence, to the change. We have an aversion to, like I said, what is happening that we don't want to be happening. So again, if we can renounce our, you know, attachment to how things should be, how we want things to be, or how we don't want them to be, an easy way to sum it up is to say, then there's no problem. It's not easy to do. I'm making this sound very simple, but it's not, of course. It is simple, but it's hard. And maybe the, you know, in my story of the cups, you know, so I have an aversion to those other cups because I like these cups. I like these three cups, so I have an aversion to all the others. Or I really like that street in that neighborhood in that apartment where I lived, and so I have an aversion to all the others. And the people that live in that street, in that building, in that neighborhood, I really like, and so I have aversion to the people who don't live in that neighborhood. Or, you know, whatever it is. And ignorance, you know, the third poison is basically just not seeing things as they are. It's, you know, like hanging on to how we think they should be or how we believe they are or the mind games that we're creating that convince us they're a certain way. And we say that's ignorance in the sense of not like intellectual ignorance. Not like, oh, you don't know how to, you know, you don't know how to do trigonometry, or you don't know how to sew a rakusu or something. That's something that most people confront when they're making a rakusu is, oh, I don't know how to sew. Except a few people who do, but everyone else is, I don't know how to sew. We're not talking, I mean, we could say that's a belief that we become attached to, which then limits us. Whereas if we renounce it, and anyone who makes a rakusu eventually renounces that belief and just does it. None of you would be sitting here with rakusus if you hadn't renounced that belief. You know, the only one probably present here who really knows how to sew is Anna. The rest of us are amateurs. But we did it, right? And those who haven't done it, I'm sure you could do it too if you wanted to. And so when we renunciation, I really like this notion of renunciation being a choice to be free. Because then you're free of this stuff that you've been hanging on to. And then, well, as we say, there's antidotes to these three poisons. So then the generosity, which is the antidote to greed or attachment, it's like I said, you know, then I can use any cup and I can offer any cup to someone else. Because if I'm attached to mine and someone comes for tea, well, then I'm not going to give them my cup. I have to have my cup. I'll give them some other cup, right? Or, you know, I wouldn't have been able to leave my apartment in the Marais and come and live in Montreuil. I would have been so limited. And then, you know, the second episode, the second chapter of that story is when I left the house in Montreuil and lived in an apartment in Paris again, because the house I'm living in now was being renovated. It was terrible. I had a whole nother renunciation to do. I was like, well, if I don't live there in that house, in that Zen center, well, who am I? I was completely identified with it again, you know, again. I think the second time it didn't take me as long to let go of it. And when I did, I felt so free. It was so great. I felt like I had so much space. Wow, I had my own apartment. I mean, I literally did have more space than the one room I was living in, with people sitting by my bed to wait for Daisan with Roshi. But it was a space in my being that was more important than the space, literal space of my apartment. And if you look into your lives, you will see cases like, you will see situations like this. That's why I said to this person yesterday, look closer. And be interested, you know, be interested in what, you know, it's like, those are the two basic, one of the basic things about sitting is, be, you know, this inquiring mind, this pay attention to your experience, notice it. And I guess the other aspect is to not judge, right? So not, to not think of it as your experience is good or bad, or true or false or something, or try to situate it or try to understand it, but just inquire. That's this beginner's mind that we've been talking about too, right? And see the objects, the thoughts that your mind is creating as just that. It's just thoughts. It's like in a dream, stuff that comes up. And as long as you're in the dream, asleep, it makes total sense, the dream. When you wake up and you look back at it, you think, wait, what a minute, what was going on in that dream? How could I be in those two places at the same time? And what was that person doing there? And then they became something else, and you know, all this stuff going on. It doesn't make any sense once you wake up. Well, it's the same thing. The objects, the mind objects and the stuff, the thoughts and all this stuff we have, it's like that. As long as we're asleep, it makes total sense. But when we wake up and see things as they are, it's like, well, of course, you know, and we can even look and say, well, like Jeff Bezos thinks that, you know, having a bigger rocket and going farther into space than Richard Branson is going to make him happy fundamentally. I mean, and we can look at that and say, well, he's crazy. It's like insane. Or I even heard that Jeff Bezos, bought a $500 billion super yacht. It's an amazing thing. And then, because his partner, his new girlfriend, is a helicopter pilot, and on this super yacht that he bought, there was no helicopter landing pad. He bought a supporting yacht that has a landing pad on it so that she could fly her helicopter and land on the the yacht next to him. And you think, wow, you know, how could that really ease, cure his fundamental hunger? You know, the basic hunger that we all have. We can look at it, you know, because it's so outrageous and say, it's impossible. How could he really be happy with that? You know, this phallic rocket that goes like, you know, Richard Branson, they were having a race to see who would go first. And Richard Branson went first, got ahead of him. But Jeff Bezos went farther and went to like to the edge of outer space or something like that. So you think, well, how could that really? It's like, you know, we think, well, okay, I'm going to have this amazing car, you know. A Triumph Spitfire convertible or something, you know, this amazing sports car. Is that really going to make me happy? I mean, fundamentally, basic happiness, I think we all know the answer, right? But can we look at this and see that we do that kind of stuff, not only with luxurious objects, but with scenarios in our mind and stuff, other stuff we're hanging on to or believing will make us happy, let's say, you know, something like that. So just sitting down like we do is, you know, we're way ahead of Jeff Bezos, you know. He maybe went to the edge of outer space, but I don't know how much time he's spent sitting on a cushion, going deeply into his being. I think if he had, he wouldn't have done all that. So, all of that from this little exchange I had with someone about greed. And looking closer. It's amazing. It's fascinating, actually, to look closer. I mean, I love it. I can't think of anything better. Not as a, like navel gazing, like focusing on myself. And it's not a narcissistic thing. It's an inquiry into the nature of being, to the nature of your being and the being of all things. And it's just, wow. Fascinating. So, I mean, this practice is fascinating because it's so basic. You just sit down and do nothing. And so radical. So, if anyone wants to say anything, Lisa, yeah?
I guess you can also be clinging to that, this practice.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And how do you see that as clinging to it?
Well, it could be... I'm trying to think if it's high. I ever did it that way, but it could be probably. Filling in the gap or something that you feel, the one that I feel. And so you sit for your practice because maybe, you know, something is missing, so that's how you fill the gap.
By
engaging in this practice.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you mean by engaging in the practice, because if you engage in the practice, you're not going to find anything to fill up. No, there you won't find any filling and you won't find anything to fill up.
Well, it's something that's regular and, you know, you're with other people and you have a daily, a yearly meeting and...
Oh, okay. You know. So if you approach it like just an activity that you do.
But yeah.
Without really plunging into it. Okay, yeah, that's true. And I think generally...
Well, you need to form.
That's absolutely, yeah, that's true. And usually what happens with that, I forget who I was having a discussion with this about, is in that case, oh no, it wasn't anyone here, it was someone else, yeah. Eventually it wears out and people either stop because it's just something else they do, and doesn't they become dissatisfied with it, or it doesn't have any meaning really, and so why do it, you know? Or they become really disillusioned with it. They didn't arrive where they thought they would arrive. Sometimes it can lead to a deep existential crisis, and then they let go of that approach that they had. Or, you know, they continue on when you say attached to the forms. Yes, that's entirely possible. And usually, however, there will be some dissatisfaction with that because it's not enough somehow. Like Bernie Glassman used to say when someone, I heard him say this at a conference once, someone said, how do I know if this practice is for me? What if it's not, you know, what if there's some other practice that I should be doing? You know, should I maybe try a Tibetan thing or not meditation? Maybe I should do yoga or I don't know, something. And he said, well, there's only one way to find out. You do it completely. And then if you really do it completely, you realize one of two things. You will realize this is practice is completely for me, or you will realize it's not at all for me. But you have to completely do it in order to realize that. And so I think, you know, that's kind of, if I'm understanding your question, if people completely throw themselves into the form, or, you know, that can be like just the Sangha is really important. But already if the Sangha is really important, there's something happening more than just an ordinary activity. There's a deep practice going on if we're engaged with the Sangha. So I don't know if that answered your question.
I don't think I was expecting any specific answer. So my question wasn't quite clear, but
okay.
Yes, it's perfect.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, hi everyone. I'd like to share that very often it happens to me, I mean not very often, but it happens to me from time to time when I'm interacting with someone that does things that I find very impressive, and there's a sense of not only envy, like I want this for me, but also I want this for me. And then I realize I notice how it puts me kind of off balance, and I really need to go backwards, to step down and step away and have a look of, wait, what's my life? What is important for me? Because I can get carried away by Yeah, someone who has like a life that I think, oh my God, this must be so great to be in his shoes. And I really want that. And it really puts me off balance for a moment. And it can last 24 hours, 48 hours. And I really need to, yeah, ask myself the question, what do I want? Why do I do what I do? What are my deepest aspirations? So even if they are even for me, even if they are really grounded, I notice how it's they are, can I can be easily be kind of yeah be off balance by an interaction that I have.
Yeah. Well, and you kind of described the toxic Facebook life, you know, and because that's exactly what happens with the social networks is exactly that. Oh, these other people have this amazing life, you know. I would love to have that life. Or they have beautiful children, or they have a great job, or they had great vacation in Ibiza or whatever. Yeah.
And actually, the question that helps me to go back to my deepest aspiration is the question, would I want to do what is required to do to have the life that I was actually looking at, that for a moment that looked appealing? And very often it's like, no, no way, no way. But I need to have the I do need to ha make the effort to go into that kind of inquiry.
Well, and you see how valuable that is to have that experience, because now when you have students, but you being a teacher, you know, when you have students who are involved in that kind of thing and don't see it, you can who are attached to some idea of how they want things to be, or it doesn't have to be like someone else's fabulous life, but it can be something other than what is. You can see how it goes from your own experience, and you can see how you deal with it then. Debbie?
I don't want this to be playing devil's advocate, but just as you were saying that, I was thinking, okay, but what do you do with motivation? I mean, if I don't project a more accomplished me in the future, especially as I have very comfortable means, I think I'd eat ice cream and sit zazen. That would probably be it. I'd just get up in the morning, sit, eat ice cream and nap. I mean, what about motivation to change the situation, my situation, so that I am a more productive, kinder, know what I'm saying? And not just whatever accepting things as they are means. I'm not really sure I know what that, I've ever known what that means. But just accept that everything's fine. I'm in good health and my house is nice and I don't have to rob a bank and but I want more for myself all the time. Not for myself, but of myself, I guess. And I feel that that's a good thing.
So, well, the question is what that you what do you What's the question, really?
Well, Joe was talking about envying, I think, envying someone else's life. I'm not talking about envying someone else's life, but wanting to make my life richer, better, more productive, kinder, Mm-hmm. If I don't do that, I mean, if I, that's going on in me all the time. Is that not accepting things as they are?
No. See, this is how our mind function, our dualistic mind functions. It's either we have to like resist and try to control everything, or we're just totally passive and we just let things fall apart, you know? But the middle way, quote, is not one, not the other. The middle way is to see the impermanence and the interconnection. And when we see that, we see then how things work. And so we water the plants because we know that the plants grow and function well when we water them and they have sunlight. Instead of just keeping them in a dark room and never watering them, we open the window, the shutters, and we water them. Or for our own well-being, we know our body is healthier if we go out for a walk and get some exercise. And if we don't just sit there and eat ice cream and watch movies and sit zazen, we know that for our body is healthier. When we can, let's see, how can I say this? When we can see things clearly, you know, like in the proverbial jar of dirty water, when it settles and the water's clear, then we can see what needs to be done to maintain the harmony, to restore justice. I don't know. Doesn't mean that there's nothing to do, but we act in accordance with things as they are then, instead of going against them or trying to make them different. Different in the sense of controlling. Oh, we lost Debbie there. That was a weird experience. I felt like I was like looking at Debbie and then boom, she disappeared. Very interesting experience. I wonder what that means. Oh, there she is. She never went, she didn't even go anywhere, right? She has no idea she disappeared from the screen. Oh, you do know that you just, now we can't hear you, but I think you're saying.
You all disappeared for me, so did I disappear for you?
Yeah.
And that's, okay, that was the answer to the question.
I guess so, you know, it's like, you know, we have this thing of like, you know, reality seems to be physical and concrete and a certain way, and we become very attached to that. But when we have an experiential, when we have a direct experience of things as they are, then suddenly it's not what we thought it was. And then we can freely act, you know. It's like, you know, choosing to be free again. We can freely act to not do harm, to help the neighbor lady who can't walk up the steps with her bags of groceries or whatever it is. Instead of just walking by and saying, I don't care, it doesn't matter to me. So it is, she's old and she should carry her own bags up, you know. Not my problem. When we see things as they are, we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't say that.
Well, I think I'm not talking as much about the actual actions as the place of motivation to, I don't know, change, learn new things. Mm-hmm. And that is not, well, then I don't know what seeing things as they really are means, maybe. I don't know, maybe I don't understand what the expression refers to.
Well, when you say your motivation to, what did you say, motivation to learn new things or?
Learn new things, be a better person, enrich my environment, be right. More, you know, all the things, positive things.
Right. You know, it doesn't sound like that's coming from a place of attachment to or an aversion to, like you're running away from how your life is now. And our motivation, what is our motivation to be? You know, is it to do harm or is it to do good? Good. Is it for growth? You know, like you said, to grow, to learn new things. That's very different than a motivation to accumulate or to resist or to, you know, make yourself look 20 years younger or I don't know. There's a difference between, you know, changing your diet so that you can lose, you know, almost like become anorexic, or changing your diet so that, because you know that it's better for your body, that it's more healthy to eat certain things and to not eat other things. There's a difference in the motivation there. And the when we say seeing things as they are, having a direct experience, it's as opposed to ideas and intellectual beliefs, scientific. I read this thing where it's an Australian philosopher did this, so presented this. I don't know, Donnie, we would call it this story, where a hypothetical woman who was a, you know, neurophysicist or something was born colorblind. And she studied color, right? So she knew everything that you could know about scientifically about color, how color arises, you know, what makes color, all of the, you know, chemical things with color and the light, the way that light creates color and all of this. She knew all of this. She was a specialist scientist specializing in color. And then at some point, medicine, the medical community developed some treatment for colorblindness, and she was cured of her colorblindness. And she saw a tomato, she saw red for the first time. It completely changed her life. She had a direct experience of red, which was, so it was like she was leaving this realm of intellectual knowledge and entering the realm of experiential knowledge. There's no comparison between having an experience of red, direct experience of seeing red, and studying all there is to know about the color red. And so when we say seeing things as they are, that's what we're talking about. That it's not clinging to intellectual beliefs or how we, you know, stuff that we've developed for years and years and years of how things are, which are usually materialistic. It's having a direct experience of how things are, direct experience of impermanence, of change and interconnection.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's a linguistic thing, because I know I've asked you this, what it means before. So I'm not improving on this, but I heard what you're saying more this time.
Well, you know, my ability to explain it is limited. So, you know, maybe someday we'll get there, Debbie.
Well, maybe it's my ability to hear it. It may have something to do with it.
Maybe someday I'll be able to say it just perfectly. I doubt it, but. can always have that aspiration, right?
Well, there was also a thing in during when we were setting the slogans about there is no such thing as progress. It's the same sort of, but there is such a thing as progress. You do get better. You do lose that unnecessary weight. You are more supple. And I got very hooked up on that too. So it may be the words that I'm all messed up about.
Yeah, well, there's also this thing of changing but not going anywhere. And so when we say there's no progress, it's like that. It's like there's change, but it's always here. We're not going anywhere. We're not getting any better or worse. Things are not getting better or worse. They're just different. Things are just changing. That looks like that made you even more confused. So I think I should probably stop there or my eyebrows will fall out. So but really, you know, there's nothing to know. You just sit. Just sit. You know, follow Dogen's thing. Study the self. Forget the self. And when you forget yourself, you know, you're actually in the middle of true activity. You know, there's always a personal and an impersonal. And we tend to become stuck on the personal. But when we can let go of that, renounce that personal, then the impersonal is vast and wide and so free. So I think we should stop there. Say the vows.